Bob Shane of the Kingston Trio, we want to welcome you to Folk Classics.
Thank you.
We are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Kingston Trio. You, of course, retired back in 2004. The trio is still going very, very strong. But I want to go back to that year of 1957 and find out exactly when did the clock start ticking to measure off 50 years of the Kingston Trio?
How would I know?
Well, then who should I talk to?
I can't remember yesterday. Oh, you know, we just got out of college, and I went back to Hawaii to do my own thing, and Dave and Nick started a quartet with Joe Gannon and Barbara Bogue, and then Barbara and Joe quit, and Nick called me and asked if I'd like to come back up and start a trio, and so I came back up from Hawaii, and we went to work practicing a group at, and working at the place called the Crackpot in Redwood City, California, and there's a little beer garden very close to both Stanford and Menlo, and where we went to school. And Frank Werber came in and saw us there and liked our act and asked us if we wanted a representation, and we said yeah, and he signed an agency contract with us on a paper napkin, which is about all we had to write on at the time, and rest is history.
When we spoke one time a little bit earlier, and you mentioned the Purple Onion, and it's really the date that began the Kingston Trio formally.
Not really, because as far as working in a professional environment on a regular basis, that's the first one. But we actually did some stuff before that at the San Mateo County Fair and at things in the park in San Francisco with the Four Lads and stuff like that. But they were just little things that were just testing us to get us ready for an engagement at the Purple Onion. And so the Purple Onion actually was the start of working steady on a professional basis.
And you opened up for a familiar comedian?
For Phyllis Diller, yes.
Back on, this is May 27th, 1957.
Yeah.
And you went from there, you started performing in other places around the country, Mr. Kelly's in Chicago, the Village Vanguard in New York, but you really didn't vault into the national consciousness until 1958 with that particular song that sold 3 million copies.
Yeah.
And that would be Tom Dooley. How did that happen? You were not even aware of what was going on at the time, is that right?
Yeah, we got the song, we first heard the song done by a fellow who was auditioning for a job at the Purple Onion. And our office was upstairs from the Purple Onion at the time, and we heard this guy doing this, doing Tom Dooley as a trial period for his stay there, and the audition for him didn't work, I guess. But we lifted that song and researched it and came out with it on our first record. The interesting thing about Tom Dooley is that the song only had two chords in it, and over the years it sold something like 10 million records. And the other thing is that it was a real song about a real person who was written by himself, by Tom Dooley, when he was incarcerated in 1863 through 65 or 6, I guess. And finally hanged around that time after being in prison for 3 years. And, of course, you know, after selling millions of records of this, we happened to go to the gravesite of Tom Dooley in North Carolina. And while there, an old gentleman said to me, you should go check out the trial, the minutes from the trial, which it was in Statesville, North Carolina at the time. And so we went down there, and he said all during his trial that he had not killed the girl, but if he had, it was because she gave him syphilis. Now, that, you know, what do you tell the kids? Come on. And that was very interesting to us, because that is real Americana, that, you know, the things you don't think about in songs.
But a couple of DJs in Salt Lake City, Utah, were the ones that brought it to national attention. Is that true?
Yes, Paul Coburn and Bill Terry were the two disc jockeys that started playing it at KLUB in Salt Lake City, And then they liked it so much they called friends of theirs in various places around the country who were disc jockeys, and they all jumped on it and started playing it at the same time. It was just one of those things that just happens out of pure luck.
You've told a story about how you evolved from being a country group to being folk singers. So you want to let our listeners know about that a little bit?
Oh, that was we weren't anything. You see, we'd never been anything. We've never claimed to be folk singers. We never claimed to be anything except entertainers. But in order to sell records, they had to call you something and put you in a bag so that they could try and promote in that genre. And the amusing thing is Tom Dooley, at the time of the first Grammys in 1958, they didn't have a folk singing category the first year. That didn't come until 59. And so they wanted to give us a Grammy the first year for Tom Dooley. And here Capitol Records had just called us folk singers. And lo and behold, they had no folk singing category. So they looked around and realized that in 1957 and 1958, country music was at an all-time low in sales. And it was like, you couldn't sell anything. And so they used us to help them out by giving us the first Grammy ever given for Best Country and Western Performance of the Year. And the country singers have never paid any attention to us, and chances are the country music business wouldn't even be where it is today if it hadn't been for the Kingston Trio. You know, but hey, if it can't make any money out of it, forget it.
Between the period 1957 to 61, you had 10 very successful albums. You did concerts all over the country. You were on TV, national TV, many, many times. In fact, I can tell our listeners that if they go to YouTube and click on Kingston Trio, they can see your performance on the Jack Benny program.
Yeah, I saw that just recently.
And definitely at the top of your game in 1961, and then there was a transition. Can you let our listeners know a little bit about that transition from Dave Gard to John Stewart?
Well, Dave was very, very unhappy with some of the things that were happening. Dave was also into other things that were, well, let's just say he was doing some psychedelics that nobody'd ever heard of way before it was popular, and experimenting with the hallucinogenic drugs and things. And he was getting a little nervous by it, and he had some issues with things that were happening. And that after discussing it with him many years later, I realized he probably had a pretty good feel for what was going on, and I could see how it would make him upset. And we got to be quite friendly towards the end again, and it was very good. But he went in a different direction. He didn't want to do what we were doing at the time, and so he just said, "I gotta quit." So we said goodbye and paid him a large stipend, and that was it.
And John Stewart joined you pretty quickly?
Well, we auditioned several people before we took John Stewart. One of the guys was McGuinn from the Byrds. He was our first audition, but he was only 18 and couldn't play in clubs. And then we auditioned Chip Hazlitt, Chip Douglas, actually. He became the one of the Modern Folk Quartet, and he was the guy that produced the Monkees on record. And he was also too young to play with us, and he was a good friend, being from Hawaii the same as I was. And then we auditioned Stewart, but the minute we got Stewart, realized he was old enough to play in the clubs, and also he'd written songs for us, and we felt that was going to possibly help in the future because we were running pretty short of original, you know, folk-type material. You know, as I said, we never called ourselves folk singers, but what we did was we created world music before there was ever a name for it because we like stuff from all over the world. If we heard a song we liked, it didn't make any difference where it was from. We'd just do it.
A lot of Spanish and French songs and stuff like that, yeah. How many songs ended up being in your repertoire? I think I read somewhere around 400.
It's close to 400, yeah.
John Stewart joined you in 1961. The group stayed together and did very well until 1967. What brought you guys to the end of the road at that point?
There were the Beatles and the change in musical tastes at the time with folk rock and then rock and roll. And then it was time. And it wasn't until about a year later after I had been out doing my solo thing that I realized how much more I enjoyed singing as a group, at which time I leased the name New Kingston Trio and started selling it as that. And then I ended up buying the name in 1976 and continued doing it to this day.
The New Kingston Trio started out with you and Pat Horan and Jim Connor.
Right. And then ended up with Roger Gamble and Bill Zorn. At the time I was with them is when I bought the name. So Bill was actually with us as the Kingston Trio for a short time. And, of course, he took my place recently.
We'll talk about that in a little while. And then somebody else joined the group in 1976. That's still with him, almost 30 years. It'll be 29 years, I guess, this year. And that would be George Grove.
Yeah, that's George joined us after I was playing with Roger for a while. And George came in 76, and then we went until 85 when Roger passed away.
Yeah, Bob Hayworth joined you briefly, and then Nick came back in 1988. Nick Reynolds
did. Right. He stayed with us for 10 years, and then Bob Hayworth came back in, and then Hayworth went off to do his own thing, the group sort of evolved into what it is today, and I think that the group that is in existence today will probably keep working for some time. They're all good friends. They all sing beautifully. They all have a great feeling for each other, and that's what the trio has always been about, is camaraderie and respect for each other and each other's musical taste and each other's feelings in general. And they all get along well, and like we did in the beginning with Dave, and then it evolved into, it always happens that way, it seems. In the beginnings of any popular group, it seems that sooner or later one guy is a dissident, you know, and he's got to do his own thing, or he demands that everybody do it his way, which was the case of Dave. He said, either you do it my way or I quit, and we said goodbye, you know.
Yeah. You kind of anticipated one of my questions, which was going to be, what about the Kingston Trio in the next 50 years? But you're saying that Bill Zorn and Rick Daugherty and George Grove are going to stick around for a little while longer.
Well, they're my retirement. Yeah, Bill lives about 4 minutes from me, actually, and George is up in Vegas, which we go up to every once in a while, because Rick lives in the Bay Area. But they're just getting ready to cut a new CD for the first time in many years of new material, and we're really excited about that. I'm just still working on my book of short stories and a CD of both old arrangements and new arrangements of solos, and just trying to keep our business going.
Well, they're still playing to sold-out audiences. We are very much looking forward to them appearing here at Sellersville, just about 45 minutes down the road from here in December, and hopefully we can be in touch with them and maybe even get them over here.
Oh, yeah, you'll love it. They're doing fantastic. They're very, very successful.
Before I ask you about the song that is Bob Shane's signature song, I just want an opinion from you. It's 50 years and counting, I like to say. And why do you think the group's music has endured for so long and will continue to endure?
Because it's of simplicity and the fact that anybody could pick up a guitar and sing along with our stuff, and did. And even the Martin Guitar Company admitted that we put them several years behind in production of D28s and guitars in general because of the fact that so many people wanted to get guitars that we had. And that's why later this summer, the 0021 model, which was what the model that Dave Gard played, will be released in celebrating our 50th anniversary of the trio.
Well, we're going to be hearing from Dick Boak as well about the Kingston Trio, so we look forward to that. The story of Scotch and Soda. Scotch and Soda is your signature song. You've sung it tens of thousands of times, and people really associate that song with you. They love the song. They sing along with it.
Uh-huh.
And how did the Kingston Trio actually acquire that song? You mentioned earlier that
Dave had gone out one or two nights with a girl by the name of Katie Sievers at Stanford. And she had said that her parents lived in Fresno and heard that we were going to drive down to Los Angeles in my 49 Pontiac Slopeback. And we said, you know, we would stop by. That was, I think it was around Thanksgiving, as a matter of fact, and we stopped and had dinner with the Seavers family. This, of course, was Tom Seaver, the baseball pitcher. This was his mother and father, and at the time that we got the song from them, he was about 9 years old. So this is dated. It was about 1954, 55. And after dinner, they said, you know, we heard this song in 1932 written by a backroom piano player, and we would go in every night, and he would play the song for us, and we called it our song, you know, for the like you do when you go on honeymoon. And they asked him to write it out because they played the piano. And he wrote the thing out, but he didn't sign it. And they forgot what his name was. And years later, they pulled this thing out of the piano bench, and they played it and realized that the guy had not signed it. And Dave originally put his name on it without our knowing it. And he put his name on that and Worried Man and a couple of others to supposedly to give the royalties to the Seaver family and this and that. And the statute of limitations went by before we could stop it. And so Dave's name ended up. And then so when we accosted Dave on it, we said, and he agreed to share it three ways. And he never did. And I think that stuff like that and bad karma like that is probably some of the things that happened to Dave along the way that gave him a bad feeling.
Well, we mentioned earlier that Scotch and Soda is your signature song, and I read somewhere in one of the histories of the Kingston Trio that Frank Sinatra said not even he wouldn't dare to cover that song. It's really Bob Shane's song.
No, so. That's not what he said. He said, don't ever cover a song that was done really well to start with unless you can make it better. And Frank didn't think he could make it any better than it was, so I felt that that was probably the best compliment I ever had from somebody who was one of my favorite singers of all time. And it was cut by many other people, by the Manhattan Transfer and this and that. But you'll find in most musical situations, when you hear a song that really turns you on to start with, most people feel very incest that somebody else tries to make the same song when the first one was so good. And I've always felt that that was the thing, too, is that it's like movies. If you see a movie that you really like, you know, and then they come out with this, you know, a remake of it later on, unless it can be done even way better, you should never even try to do it.
Thanks for clarifying that story, Bob. Again, congratulations. 50 years of the Kingston Trio.
Well, thank you.
And it's a pleasure to talk to you. We hope to still keep in touch with you as the years go on. And talk to you again. Maybe we'll get you back on Folk Classics. What do you say?
Anytime.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.